Canadian political analysis for a global audience.
I'm Yaroslav Garan.
And I am Balkan Devlin.
I'm Heather Bakken. Today we are going to be talking about the Cabinet Planning Forum for the Canadian government, the Majors Projects Office that opened in Calgary, Alberta, and Shanghai Corporation Organization's summit in China. Balkan, let's start with you. And if you could just frame the implications of this summit. And also yesterday we witnessed the largest military parade ever.
I think two things are quite crucial. And I think we need to sort of focus on that in a separate way. One is the SCO summit that China put out in Tianjin in China with a lot of fanfare. Not only the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization showed up, but also there were associated countries such as Turkey that did come to this particular meeting. Yes,
and Turkey absolutely. And Slovakia are both NATO members.
Absolutely. So, so number one is that it's a big show. They were welcome, you know, with parades and everything else. And most important on that, and I'm going to very briefly touch upon that, is of course when India's Prime Minister Modi showed up, and we all saw the photos between Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Modi, you know, holding hands. Laughing and chatting, and what that means for emerging coalitions around the world. The other one is of course this big military parade, which marked the end of the Second World War in Asia, and thus it is also a showcase of China's military prowess. So when we combine them together, one can actually suggest that this was China's unequivocal presentation of itself as the builder of a new international order, bringing in major countries around the world, as well as showcasing its military power.
Okay, I want to ask you about that. Two things that point out, that stick out to me here. One is that Modi did not attend the military parade. So the implications of that and Canada's relationship with India directly impacted through the global geopolitical chaos that's happening right now with the repositioning and jockeying, the sub-in replacement of the performative side of the entrance with Xi Jinping, was Putin and Kim Jong-un from North Korea. So that was unusual for the leader of the Hermit Kingdom to show up in an event like that. Can you just explain the context of this for Canada, for the world, for what you think are the takeaways that people should focus on rather than the noise and the distractions?
Excellent. Let me start with the presence of Modi, and I would direct our listeners to our colleagues' piece at the Japan Times that was published today by Jonathan Berkshire Miller that deals with in depth on what India's presence in this meeting means. Very quickly, it is a sign that Modi would like to re-emphasize India's role as what some would call a swing state, an independent, autonomous actor that maintains ties with both the West and China and Russia. And this was perhaps the most clear example of Modi's modus of operandi, showing that they might have problems, and they do have a serious geopolitical problems with China, but that doesn't mean that they are not going to cooperate when they feel that it is in their interest. Now, for Canada, what is the lesson here? Couple things. One, that we also need to sort of figure out when we look at our engagement with India, particularly. We need to understand that country is going to maintain ties with both the West and others, and pursue relentlessly its national interest. Our engagement with China, with India, needs to focus on Canada's national interest, and rather than some other, assuming that India is going to be part of the Western bloc. It's not going to be. It is going to be a partner, but it is not going to be an ally. And that is important to keep in mind. And we need to focus our relationship with India on the national interest perspective.
That's excellent. And I want to give you bonus points for mentioning that it's a swing state because people are listening to the swing. So good for you. Okay. Okay. Part two of what you were going to answer.
Yes. North Korea, Russia, China show up. I think two things are important. When people talk about the axis of upheaval that highlights Korea, North Korea, China, Russia, and Iran, this is again one very solid example of those three countries particularly standing together. The second thing is that again Xi showed it very clearly that he is the boss among that group, right? Because there were some expectations that North Korea's specific increasing relations and closer relations with Russia would mean that North Korea may be sort of having more autonomy. This made it very clear that it is China that sustains both of the regimes, both Putin's regime and enable its war against and on Ukraine, as well as North Korean support for Russia's war in Ukraine. It is, in other words, those things are not possible or won't be possible without the blessing of Xi Jinping. And that photo that we all saw is, I think, a very, very clear example of who is the boss in this relationship.
Glad you brought that up, and also Ukraine. Yaroslav, this is your wheelhouse. We are in a pivot point of our security and defense planning right now. We're going to be talking about what the government's doing in a few minutes, but it's very clear that we need to establish where we stand.
We talked a little bit about this last week because it was very evident in Prime Minister Mark Carney's whirlwind tour, his highly geopolitical whirlwind tour of bilateral summits or meetings last week. But the ongoing manifestation of this is really going to be the rollout, the aggressive rollout of significant new defense spending by the government of Canada. We've already seen the lower hanging fruit. The Prime Minister announced pay raises across the armed forces, but now we're going to be getting into investing in heavy military kit with an aggressive timetable of getting billions and billions out the door between now and March 31st.
So this is a good move for democracy. In other words, it's clarifying where everybody stands. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, 100%. It's really forced NATO to do some serious introspection. I mean, it as in the current geopolitical shifts, and that has really resulted in, for example, the new Rearm Europe policy framework in the EU, a higher defense spending target for all NATO countries, and a serious look at defense sovereignty and resilience among all NATO members.
So it's refocusing the government and then potentially from that Canadians on how to protect and advance our interest and to determine what kind of trade-offs we're willing to make in that space.
It has to be quite clear to Canadians. The political elite is coming around to the fact that we need to have the guns in order to protect the butter, right? In order to maintain our way of life, our well-being, our welfare, our prosperity, we need to be better armed than our adversaries, including Russia and China. We have been neglecting this for 25, 30 years. And now the bill is due, and we might be quite late for it, but we are at least trying to ramp up and ensure that we have the means to defend our interests and our values and our way of life.
Yeah, and if I could just add a little postscript on that point, there are going to be some emerging new developments in defense policy in terms of supporting a Canadian domestic defense industrial base. There's going to be a whole lot of tension now between spending fast, so off the shelf, what's available, where can you get it? Is it South Korea? Is it Europe? Is it, wherever? Versus where in defense spending is the government of Canada going to be actively promoting a spend in Canada, made in Canada policy to prime the pumps of new defense industries here at home?
Yeah, and we have apparently our satellite surveillance is world class. That goes back to the early days of
our shipbuilding is world class. Yes.
Yeah. Expanding those capacities will also strengthen our economy. Let's actually focus on the economy right now. The Prime Minister is in Toronto today with his cabinet on what they're calling the cabinet planning forum. Apparently, there is a shift in how they're approaching this cabinet meeting. It is more focused. It is more business oriented. It is more outcome oriented. Yaroslav, this is your wheelhouse. Can you talk about what typically happens during a planning meeting and what we can expect to come out of it?
Yes, of course. And look, let's be frank. Every prime minister has a different style and brings a different style to managing cabinet meetings. Whether we want to call it a cabinet planning forum or a cabinet retreat, it's the same thing. This is the annual fall cabinet planning retreat. This happens every year around this time. Don't forget, Heather, that Parliament will be resuming on September 15th. So this is that time of year where every political party caucus holds a planning session of its entire caucus. The governing caucus, the Liberals, are going to be having their own caucus meeting in about a week's time. And this is an additional feature of this time of year. The annual planning retreat is usually a couple days where cabinet gets together and covers a whole lot of stuff. One of the key features of the fall planning retreat is the parliamentary look ahead. With Parliament opening up, there will be a comprehensive presentation from the government house leader outlining the legislative agenda for the upcoming sitting of Parliament. What bills they have in the queue for introduction, what they're going to be focusing on, what the leftover kind of mop-up business is going to be. For example, law and order, the law and order agenda is going to be on the ascendancy this fall with strong pressure from the United States to pass Bill C-2, the Strong Borders Act that the Carney government tabled in the spring. It would enhance cooperation on law enforcement significantly between Canada and the U.S., but it's also drawing criticism over civil liberty and privacy protection. So that's going to be a pretty big focal point this fall. Beyond the legislative agenda, there's also going to be discussion about economic performance. We've all been watching that this year Canada's economy has been lackluster, and the threat of a clinical recession persists. The report from Statistics Canada, for example, a few days ago, that indicated that the Canadian economy actually contracted 1.6% in the second quarter, and that was following basically a flat line in the first quarter. And technical recession is two consecutive quarters of contraction. So Canada may be in a recession right now. We just don't know it yet. We'll know for sure when the Q3 numbers come out. So there's definitely going to be an update on economic indicators and overall economic performance.
And also there's an upcoming federal budget.
Yes, of course. I can only assume that there will be some sort of a preview of how budget planning is proceeding. The Department of Finance right now is holding a series of stakeholder roundtables thematically in preparation for the budget. They've just closed the process of receiving written submissions from any stakeholder who wants to submit. And so the budget planning is going full tilt. I'm hearing that the general expectation is a federal budget in October, but that could very well slip a little bit. I would not be surprised at all if that slipped into November by a little bit.
Really? Don't think the timing after Thanksgiving, where people typically, you know, it's kind of the kitchen table conversations, and the MPs go to home to their constituents and promote it?
Yeah, in an ideal world, that would be optimal timing. It's less about the strategy of it and more about, will they be ready? There's so many moving targets right now, given the economic reverberations of the geopolitical shifts that we've been discussing. The Department of Finance is always in this position of, yeah, we can go now, but in 2 weeks we'll have better data. And give us 3 more weeks and we'll have a clear picture on X or Y or Z. So there's always sort of internal pressure to keep sliding a little bit. It's been a chaotic year, and it's a high stakes budget. So I would not be surprised if Finance Canada demanded a little bit more time. And, you know, there are some other, you know, pretty big political implication things coming down the pipe.
What kind of infrastructure projects would you say that Canada is focused on for our global listeners here in terms of investment and opportunity?
Well, the Major Projects Office, this is the implementation of the Building Canada Act. The idea here was to identify top priority national interest infrastructure projects that would be fast-tracked, that would be given sort of concierge service support from the public service to get them done and get them done quickly. Now, everything's been talked about from expanding ports to building pipelines to expanding electricity grids and so on. Now, there have been some signals from Prime Minister Carney that he may lead with the first tranche of less controversial projects. For example, expanding the Port of Montreal and, you know, rebuilding Manitoba's Port of Churchill, which would be a deep water port on the Arctic, on Arctic
waters. The only one we have.
Yeah. And the idea here would be to, you know, port expansion tends to be more consensus, and that would politically de-risk the deployment of the new fast-tracking policy framework, you know, before he moves on to other more contentious projects, such as, for example, pipelines, which have always been a political flashpoint in Canada.
Sounds like a smart strategy, actually.
Yeah.
Getting public opinion on board.
A smart strategy also in the way the government rolled out the office that's going to be governing this whole area of infrastructure.
How so?
Well, one of the big deliverables for this summer has been the establishment of the Major Projects Office. That was announced last week. It was established in Calgary, which politically was a very smart move by the Prime Minister. His party tends to be weakest in Alberta. Alberta, of course, is ground zero for Canada's oil and gas industry. So standing up this project in Alberta is a signal to Alberta that the new government is open to doing business with, you know, with the energy heartland of Canada.
And it doesn't hurt that the Prime Minister grew up in Alberta.
Yeah. And he also appointed a CEO to head up this new crown agency who comes from the energy sector, Don Farrell, former CEO of Trans Mountain. And that also is a very smart move. It's a signal to Alberta, to the oil patch, to the energy sector that they have nothing to fear. Yes, that this is going to be a pro-energy, pro-resources exercise. This is not going to be an Eastern Canadian driven, you know, West be damned kind of a tradition that previously has led to political cleavages regionally within this country.
So is it safe to say this is a pan-Canadian effort to shore up our resources, bolster our defenses, create the economic landscape for people to consider Canada as a place that's reliable, stable, and a good place to invest? Fair to say that yet at this point?
Yeah, well, that's the intent. And I mean, at this point, I'm just giving them top marks in terms of political strategy on how they got this off the ground.
Any last words from you, Balkan?
Only that the talk is quite great, but let's see whether they're going to walk the walk as well.
Okay, to be determined. Thanks, gents. Really appreciate the discussion. And I guess we'll see you back next week.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you both.